Chapter 38. As I made my way along the sidewalk, I thought about the brands on the arms of Roland and Zachary Michaud. The burns were not identical, hadn't been made by an instrument forged to leave an identifying mark. It was more like the brothers had been jabbed with sizzling blacksmith's tongs. I had no doubt Egan bore a similar scar. He would have been photographed during his intake to the county jail and later the main state prison. Finding a picture of his upper arm would take me all of 15 minutes' worth of phone calls. Maybe the mark was just a rite of initiation, the necessary act before you were admitted into Pierre Michaud's confidence. The fact that the Poacher King himself hadn't had the same raised scar strongly suggested he'd been the one who'd inflicted it. The man had hot irons aplenty at his smithy. I was torn about what to do next. I couldn't get past the guilt of not being at Danny's side. The fact that Kathy said her temperature had stabilized seemed like yet another rationalization. Her fever could always worsen again. And yet, I could hear Charlie's cryptic message as clearly now as when he'd said it. They're not going to stop now, not after what just happened. All we need is another day. We're so close to the truth, and they're getting sloppy. Should I find a hardware store where I could buy supplies to patch up my truck? Maybe book a room for the night at the motel across the street from the border checkpoint? I could begin asking around town who might own a monster truck customized for mudding expeditions. In a few hours, I should easily be able to narrow the list to 50 individuals, not counting the Jeep abusers across the border. In the end, I did none of these things because when I returned to my scout, I found a note on my seat. Meet me at 7 at the fort. The note had been written on a brown paper towel of the kind you find in gas station restrooms. The writing was done in block letters. The ink was blue and didn't bleed into the paper, so probably a cheap ballpoint pen. My first thought was that Charlie had left it for me, but there was something about the note's terse anonymity that made me discard that possibility. Who, then? There was no lack of candidates. It could have been Chasse LaMontagne or any of the law enforcement officers I'd dealt with that day, excepting Plourde, who likewise hadn't left the restaurant. It could have been Nick Francis, who seemed to be assisting Charlie in this madcap investigation. It could have been Roland Michaud, for that matter, as he'd seen my vehicle outside Angie's house. Or maybe Egan had changed his mind about talking to me. Had he seen me drive off in the scout? Last but not least, it could have been the son of a bitch who'd tried to run me off the road. Just because a trap is poorly set doesn't mean it's not a trap. At least I didn't have to guess at the indicated location. Fort Kent is named for a still-standing blockhouse made of rough-hewn timbers at the edge of the river. The structure commemorates the only bloodless war in American history. Mere months after the Battle of Yorktown, Great Britain and the United States had begun quarreling over where to draw the new nation's northern border. The argument escalated over the decades to what became known as the Aroostook War of 1838 to 1839, when Congress authorized 50,000 troops to march north, led by General Winfield Scott, later hero of the Mexican-American War. For a year, American and British soldiers built fortifications and aimed cannons at each other across the St. John, but no shots were ever fired. The combatants chose negotiation over combat, and the international boundary between Maine and Canada was forever fixed by that agreement between Queen Victoria's canny emissary, Lord Ashburton, and the bedeviled Daniel Webster. For a historic monument, the blockhouse couldn't have been more strangely situated. It was tucked behind a lumber yard at the edge of a residential neighborhood. Like the war it commemorated, Fort Kent seemed more of an afterthought than an important chapter in U.S. history. I checked my watch and decided I had time to bandage up my scalp before my clandestine meeting. I paid a visit to a hardware store and filled a shopping cart with everything I would need to keep out the weather. After I had taped up the window, I drove to the small wooded park that surrounded the fort and parked the Scout out of sight. Inside the vehicle, under the still-functioning dome light, I checked my Beretta, then dropped 3 15-round magazines into the pockets of my Fjallraven jacket where I could grab them in a gunfight. I tested the razor edge of my knife against the hair along the back of my hand. It was a Gerber 06 automatic that my friend Billy Kronk, Logan's dad, had carried with him in Iraq and Afghanistan. Occasionally, when I was sharpening it, I would experience a disquieting sensation that made me think Billy had killed a man in combat with this blade. The last weapon I took was the baton maglite I had used as a patrol warden. The thing was as long as my forearm and required 6 D-cell batteries, but it could light up the eyes of a raccoon across a football field. As a last resort, the metal tube could serve as a makeshift club capable of shattering a nose. At this latitude, there should have been 2 more hours of daylight, but the low ceiling of clouds meant that darkness would arrive before civil twilight. Shadows would be seeping from every tree at the time of the meeting. While I waited, I sent an email to Aura telling her I had seen her husband, that he was alive and well, but he had slipped away again. I told her I hoped to find him again soon. I also asked that she alert me when her daughter arrived from Florida. The thought of my ex-girlfriend returning to Maine disquieted me. Even from 2,000 miles away, Stacy had cast a shadow over my relationship with Danny. She still made guest appearances in my dreams, often in risque scenarios. Despite my best efforts, I found myself drawing comparisons. Danny came out on the better end of most of the pros and cons, but not all of them. Danny's recent declaration that she would never have children had rattled me. I had always assumed I would be a father. I desperately wanted a son or daughter, in fact. But I loved Danny. I wasn't sure what I would do if I believed she was resolute in her desire to remain childless. As I had feared, my body had begun to stiffen and ache from the crash. My shoulder hurt especially. I tried to clear my head and rest, but my worries wouldn't leave me alone. Eventually, I drew my hood over my head and left the shelter of my vehicle. Being outdoors was the only reliable way I knew to quiet my troubled mind. The fort loomed in the failing light, a square, top-heavy structure with a second floor that was greater in area than the first. The roof was shaped like a pyramid. The blockhouse might have looked like something out of The Last of the Mohicans if not for the lawn-mounted spotlights shining up against the graffiti-carved, rough-hewn walls. Beyond the fort, the land tumbled down to a lower parking lot with picnic tables and steel grills. Under the sheltering leaves of ancient maples, I wandered down the hill to the water's edge. There, I stood upon the banks of the Fish River as it rushed to join the St. John. Both rivers must have recently flooded because there was mud smeared 10 feet up the tree trunks and everything on the ground, the dead leaves, the severed branches, even the discarded bottles and cans was gunky with grime. I took up a position behind a sugar maple as old as the fort itself and waited. At 7:15, I spotted headlights coming down the one-way drive. The car did not turn into the parking lot. Instead, it continued on to the adjacent lumber yard. I had no view of the higher ground. I could only listen. I heard a car door being closed with care. No voices. The park had become a patchwork of light and shadows. Illumination from the fort and the lumberyard lit up swatches between the trees, but there were just as many dark places. I watched for a flashlight beam to spark to life, but the driver seemed comfortable moving in darkness. Finally, a silhouette rose atop the hill, a person in a hooded poncho. He or she stood there a minute, and I suspected they were debating whether to wait for me in the light or find their own nest of shadows in which to hide themselves. They chose the shadows. I watched the person in the poncho begin to pick their way down the hill. The leaves were slick and muddy, but my mystery visitor seemed as sure-footed as a goat. They were halfway down when I made my move.
Hold it!
Startled, they lost their balance. They waved their arms like a flightless bird, then plopped to the ground. They slid on their backside down the rest of the hill. I was on them fast. One hand rested on the grip of my Beretta. The other brought up the mag light to shine straight into their eyes. A brown face squinted up at me from inside the hood of a green poncho. Venice? She covered her eyes with the back of her arm.
Mike, is that you?
What are you doing here?
I left you a note. Can you turn off the light, please?
After I clicked the switch, the darkness flowed back in like water welling from the river. I moved my right hand away from my gun and extended it in her direction.
Hold out your arm.
She did, and I grabbed her thin wrist. She weighed next to nothing. When she had regained her footing, I guided her out from under the trees into a pool of misted light.
What's this about, Venice? Why all the secrecy?
I needed to warn you. It's Stanley. I've never seen him like this before. I think he plans on hurting someone.
Chapter 39. We sat in her car to get out of the weather. It was a Subaru Crosstrek, late model, low miles. The absence of dog hairs on the upholstery told me Ferox was not permitted rides. Although the interior was as clean-smelling as could be, a tree-shaped air freshener hung from the rearview mirror. Venice kept digging the nails of her right hand into her thigh, leaving scratches in the denim. Every stray car that passed, its headlights sweeping the inside of the Subaru, made her catch her breath. I tapped the fragrant triangle of cardboard dangling before us.
Do you know what cops used to call these?
She shook her head. Felony forests.
I don't understand the term.
People carrying drugs think air fresheners mask the smell of narcotics in a car. All these things do is give the sniffer dogs sore sinuses. A person could write a thesis about criminals and their folklore. Maybe I should consider going back to school when I retire. She had no response to this digression, but as I'd hoped, it worked to put her at ease.
I almost didn't recognize your poor SUV, she said in her lovely accent. Were you in an accident?
I slipped off the road in the rain, I said.
Were you hurt?
Thank you for asking, but no, I'm uninjured, for once. The windows began to fog.
What's this about, Venice? Why do you think Stan is planning on hurting someone?
After you and the other warden left, she said, Stanley went into the guest room and brought out the boxes of files. He spread the papers on the dining room table. He was trying to discover what you'd been looking for. It was early, but he had begun to drink heavily. I went to take a shower. When I came downstairs, I saw him outside talking to Edouard. He seemed very angry, very insistent. I saw him give my brother the keys to the farm truck.
I had a vision of a pickup roaring up behind me along the river road. I heard the crash of my bumper crumpling. What does this farm truck look like?
It's old and rusty. Edouard uses it to carry firewood when he cuts a tree.
Do you know what a monster truck is?
Like from a demolition derby?
Does the farm truck have big tires? Does it ride high off the ground?
Yes, I suppose.
The thought of Kellum dispatching Edouard Delhomme to kill me was absurd. That wasn't to say it was impossible. Where did Stan tell Edouard to go? I asked.
Le Trou du Rat. That's Edouard's name for the cabin. It's a place he hides sometimes from the ICE agents. I have never been there. I don't think Stanley wants me to know where it is in case I'm ever interviewed by the Border Patrol.
Did you believe him? Did you believe that's where Edouard went?
At first, yes. But when I asked why Stan thought ICE was coming, he wouldn't say. He went into his den and locked the door, and I think he called someone. When he came out, he was very red in the face. His safe is inside. It is where he locks up his guns. He took a pistol but tried to hide it in his raincoat. I could see the impression. Did he tell you he was driving up here?
He said he thought he might be able to help the police catch the man who killed the girl. I asked him if he knew this Evangeline, and he said he met her a long time ago when she was a child. He knew her mother, he said.
Stan and I had lunch together this afternoon. I resisted the urge to take her hand, lest she misunderstand the intent of the gesture. I can't say he was in a good mood, but he didn't seem like he was hell-bent on murder.
Stan is an expert at hiding his emotions.
Not in my experience. You must have heard or seen something to make you so worried. You need to tell me what it was. She stared at the misted windshield. Venice?
When he was in his den, I put my ear to the door. He was trying not to be loud, but I heard him say, "He's going to destroy me." And then he didn't want me to see that he took a pistol. Stanley doesn't hide his guns because he is proud of them. He takes me target shooting.
You're sure about the pistol?
I have the combination to the safe. It is a series of numbers, in case I need to protect myself while he is away. After he left, I went into the den to check, and he had changed the combination.
Might he have done that before and forgotten to tell you?
No, because he told me to get a pistol yesterday while you were out on the lake. He never explained why. It was as if he expected someone dangerous to come to the lodge while he was gone. It was the usual combination.
I didn't know what to make of this admission, that while we'd been fishing, Stan had told Venice to arm herself. It was hardly comforting.
I have never seen him violent before, she said, but I have seen men before they commit violent acts.
As a foundation upon which to build a theory that Stanley Kellum had come to the St. John Valley to injure some unnamed person, I wouldn't have called it rock solid. But that was me thinking like a police officer. Venice knew and loved Kellum, and understood when he was acting out of his worst impulses. What has Stan told you about Scott Pellerin's disappearance? I asked.
That it was Scott's own fault. That he was cocky and gave himself away. Because Stan was the supervisor, though, everyone blamed him. They said he should have gotten Scott out of the situation sooner. Your friend the pilot was the worst, Stan says.
Kellum had expressed a similar sentiment to me. I couldn't be certain if what he regretted was his misjudgments concerning Pellerin or the damage that the affair had on his career aspirations. He might have felt both emotions at once. Venice started clawing at her thigh again.
It was Stan's plan to send in all those men into town at night. The politicians and the newspapers called it a raid, but Stan said it was a rescue mission. Michaud started the fire that burned those buildings. The wardens were not responsible, but still everyone blamed Stan. And he was mad at your friend for killing Michaud before they could find out where he'd hidden Scott's body.
That simmering resentment explained Charlie's reluctance to confront Kellum himself. She reached for a tissue and dabbed the wad at her eyes.
Stanley said that his career ended that night. Before Scott, he was going to be the colonel. But the politicians made sure he would rise no higher.
I want to get back to the phone call you overheard. You don't have any idea who he could have been speaking with.
No.
What about the person who wants to destroy him?
Your friend, I think. Is that true? Does your friend wish to destroy Stan?
She had been honest with me, and I felt she deserved the respect of a truthful answer. It's possible he does.
Why?
I'm not sure I can give you an answer that makes sense. Stan doesn't know you are in Fort Kent, does he?
No.
What might he do if he finds out you came here to tell me these things? She reacted to this question by tensing the muscles in her face. Her eyes seemed overlarge in the dimness of the car. It was as if I had insulted her virtue.
Stan loves me.
That doesn't mean...
He has never hit me. He is the first man I've been with. I can say that about. He would never hurt me no matter what I did.
As a law enforcement officer, you meet many women who are certain that their boyfriend or husband will never hurt them, not in a million years, until he breaks their arm. For her sake, I hoped Venice was right about Stan. When I returned to the scout, I saw that the rain had found the weak point in the plastic that I had taped up as a makeshift window. I tried to reattach the tape, but the water had ruined the adhesive. I let the wet air seep inside. Kellum hadn't mentioned where he was going after lunch. I had assumed back to Moccasin Pond. What would he do when he found Venice gone? It pained me not to talk this through with Charlie. He had said he'd been watching me. I wondered if he, or his proxy Nick Francis, might be doing so now. I couldn't leave the valley. Not yet. I hoped Danny would understand my decision. But until I knew Charlie was safe, I couldn't absolve myself of the promise I had made to Aura. I drove directly to the nearest motel. It was the one with the Mile Zero marker in its lot. I recognized Xanadakis' unmarked cruiser parked at the far end. It was a 2-hour drive back to the nearest state police barracks, and no doubt the detective was as aware of the danger posed by night-wandering moose as I was. Except for a nook with coffee and a rack of pamphlets advertising local attractions, the lobby felt like the living room of someone's French-speaking great-aunt. "Sorry, but we are full up," said the awkward teenage girl behind the desk. "Your sign says vacancy." "We just sold the last room a few minutes ago. I haven't had a chance to change it. I can call around and see if I can find a place for you." "Is something going on in town?" "The Muskie Derby."
Back in the 1960s, biologists in Quebec had introduced muscle lunges into Lac Frontière at the urging of local sportsmen. The fish are relatives of northern pike, but are much larger and more aggressive, reaching lengths of nearly 5 feet and weighing as much as 60 pounds. They can live as long as 30 years. Their teeth are long and sharp enough to snip off your thumb. Inevitably, the super predators got into the St. John watershed and made their way downstream into Maine, devastating every native species along the way. But at least the locals had found a way to cash in on the alien invasion. Maybe the people in the Everglades, plagued by pythons, needed to get creative with their economic development efforts. "I thought the Derby was in August," I said. "The Chamber of Commerce is doing two this summer because there are so many fish. Are you sure I can't help you find a room? Where will you sleep?"
"My truck," I said. "It won't be the first time." But in the past, the scout still had windows to keep out the mosquitoes and the rain. I was just about to leave when a realization smacked me in the forehead. "You're the girl who waited on me this afternoon at the Swamp Buck." Her smile told me she appreciated being recognized.
"This is my night job."
"It must keep you busy."
"I like to work," she said brightly.
"But it does get hard during the potato harvest. I have to get up before dawn to get my hours in on the farm, too." "Three jobs is a lot," I said.
"It is?"
She seemed genuinely baffled. I remembered seeing a drive-in campsite on the map of the Allegash River just upstream of where it flowed into the St. John. Chances were that musky fishermen had already hosied it, already laid a claim. The valley wasn't short of clearings in the woods where I could park my vehicle for the night. Thinking about Allegash Village made me recall John Egan. The red squirrel lived there, I remembered. The Deep Woods hamlet was the terminus of one of America's great canoe trips. The federally protected Allegash Wilderness Waterway was a 98-mile chain of lakes, streams, and rivers through the heart of the northern forest. Most paddlers took a week to complete the journey, camping along the way at some of the most scenic sites imaginable. The Allegash was a place people put on bucket lists. It attracted paddlers from around the world. Stacy and I had done the trip in 5 days. Even though we were young and fit, the effort had exhausted us. When we'd reached Allegash, we'd slept 12 hours at McKinnon's Lodge. The charming redhead who owned the place said the record had been set by a paddler who didn't awaken for 36 hours. She had been tempted to call her cousin the mortician. I could claim that I had forgotten that Stacy was headed north, that she would presumably be arriving in the morning in her father's borrowed plane, but it would be more accurate to say I had tamped down the thought. Seeing her again, and so soon, was more than I could deal with. I needed to refocus on the problem before me. Egan had stood up to hours of questioning after Pellerin went missing. He had done his full sentence in the prison Mainer's nickname Shawshank after the Stephen King story and movie. He had never given up his secrets. But Egan's circumstances had changed. He had a family, a baby. He was out from under Pierre Michaud's thumb, if not Roland's. And someone had brutally killed Angie Bouchard. Whatever alternate theory Xanadakis felt compelled to explore, I knew her death was a direct result of that telltale badge. She had been killed to shut her up. Her murderer would know that Egan was a potential squealer. What would Charlie do? Wrong question. What was Charlie doing? My friend would have the same instinct about Egan that I had. He would be watching the red-headed man closely. He would be waiting for him to panic and reveal some long-held secret. He would be preparing for Angie's murderer to come looking for blood. Chapter 40. The rain had stopped, but the temperature had risen. The clamminess made me remember something my father had told me about the war. In Vietnam, he had said, your uniform got soaked from two directions, from the mist seeping in and from your perspiration unable to escape. Welcome to the jungle. The road west along the St. John River had grown narrower with the ground fog. My nervous foot kept hitting the brake pedal. My imagination saw a looming moose around every bend. 20 miles out of Fort Kent, I again came to the crossroads. I passed the overgrown ruins of the Michauds' burned houses. Then the haunted Valley View Motel with its sad bilingual sign, now and forever vacant. Police tape hung across the entrance to the parking lot, a reflective ribbon. And then St. Ignace was behind me. The hamlet was no longer a real place, just words on a map that would in time disappear too. Finally, a handsome wooden sign adorned with painted oak leaves appeared in my lone headlight. Entering, a Scots-Irish community settled in 1838. I lost my cell signal long before I reached town. The village center sat at the looping confluence of the Allagash and the St. John Rivers. I paused in front of the lone eatery, closed for the night, and shined my flashlight onto the water-stained pages of my atlas, spread across the passenger seat. I had no idea where John Egan lived. I only knew that I would recognize his Toyota Tacoma, with its distinctive plow mount and safety lights, when I saw it again. Most people in the area, I guessed, lived close to the roads. The lumber company that owned 99% of the land outside town had kept residential development confined to maximize the extent of its tree-felling operations. Twin lights in the mist behind me announced the arrival of another vehicle, a large pickup from the height of the beams, but before I could reach for my handgun, the truck stopped in the road. It was too far for me to identify the color, especially with its high beams on. The driver hesitated, but not more than 15 seconds, then turned left onto a woods road. Maybe someone tailing me. Maybe not. But I had better things to do than go chasing it. I made a slow circuit of the village, sparking the interest of more than a handful of watchdogs. Porch lights snapped on as I idled outside trailers. If I had been an Allagasher, I would have grabbed my gun if a junked scout stopped outside my door. Having found no sign of Egan,
I crossed the Dickey Bridge. The span above the St. John was where the pavement ended. One could go no farther north in Maine except on private property. A handful of houses stretched out along the north bank. I didn't spot any Tacomas parked outside these residences, so I followed the road north, losing hope with every tick of my odometer. Soon I would come upon yet another gatehouse and be forced to turn back. I couldn't even call anyone for assistance, my phone being useless. I had just about given up when I saw the snowplow. It was beached in the dooryard of a modular home. Two ATVs were parked out front, his and hers, along with a Toyota 4Runner SUV that had seen better days. The reason the plow caught my attention was its color. It wasn't the golden yellow of the snow plows made by the Maine-based company Fisher. It was black and yellow. A Meyer home plow, the same maker of the mount on Egan's pickup. When I pulled into the drive, a dog began to bark inside the house. It didn't sound as fierce as Ferox, but even smaller breeds can take a hunk of meat from your calf. A motion-sensitive light came on, flooding the entire yard, catching 1,000 moths and mayflies in mid-flight. A woman holding a baby in her arms appeared in the door. She had close-cropped blonde hair and was dressed in mismatched sweats. She was at least 20 years younger than Egan, taller, too, by almost a foot. A curly-haired spaniel peeked between her long legs. Given the condition of my scout and my unkempt appearance, I wouldn't have been surprised if she'd come out shooting.
"John ain't here,"
she called from the stoop, as if this were her usual response to late-night visitors. I swung open the door and stood behind it.
"My name is Mike Bowditch. I'm an investigator with the Maine Warden Service. You're Dorothy, right?" "Yeah. John told me about you. Said you interrogated him. He ain't around."
"Where is he?"
"Why, so you can go arrest him again? The cops have already crawled all over our house."
"Your husband was never arrested."
"We have nothing to hide. Can I come up?" "I can hear you fine from there, mister."
"I think John is in danger," I said, "because of what happened to Angie Bouchard. You need to tell me where he is." Cops routinely feed people bullshit to get them to cooperate. Dorothy Egan struck me as someone who knew this. I raised my hands where she could see them to make myself less threatening. The baby opened his or her throat and let loose with a piercing cry that started the spaniel barking again.
"John can take care of himself. He wasn't scared when he left, either. He just needed to help some fool out. Be back real quick," he said.
"What fool?"
"John rents boats. Canoes, kayaks, tubes. He works for someone who does, I mean. One of the clients is up a creek without a paddle." The funny thing is, the guy's an Indian. You'd think he'd know how to paddle a damn canoe. But he flipped over going down Golden Rapids and lost his paddle and is stranded on Musket Island in the middle of the river."
There was no cell service in Dickey.
"How did he manage to contact your husband, the stranded man?" "He's got one of those CB radios."
"He lost his paddle but managed to hang on to a radio without it getting wet?"
"Look, I wasn't present for the event. I can't offer you the whys and wherefores. Now you need to excuse me. This baby requires his dinner, and I ain't going to just pull out my titty and give you a free show."
Thanks for your time, Mrs. Egan. Just one last question. Does your husband have a scar on his arm here?" I indicated my left shoulder.
"He's got a tattoo there, a flaming heart."
"Really?
I mean, he got the tattoo to cover a scar, yeah. It was a burn he suffered from falling against a radiator back when he still drank. John's a God-fearing man now. He found Jesus in prison. We go to services over in Allagash Village every Sunday. The pastor washed him clean of his sins in the river right below the church. My husband's been born again into the family of God. Can you say the same for yourself, Mr. Warden?" "I didn't think so."
Chapter 41. It was no accident that Nick Francis had contacted Egan via a two-way radio. To implement Charlie's plan, the exact shape of which still eluded me, they needed the conversation to be overheard by someone with a combination police scanner and CB unit. In Backwoods, Maine, that category of persons included everybody. But the old pilot needed a specific person to be listening. Who? Not just Egan, obviously. Like most petty criminals, Roland Michaud almost certainly owned a radio to keep track of the movements of local law enforcement. Kellum had a police scanner in his truck. I'd heard it squelch when he was writing my scout. First responders and law enforcement officers in the area all had them. Chief Plord, Xanadakis, La Montaigne. I had one too. The problem was it had stopped working during the crash. My waterlogged map showed Musket Island as a glorified sandbar downstream of St. Ignace. It probably spent half its year underwater. The river was running high at the moment from all the rain. I wondered how much of the little island was above the surface. Charlie and Nick had a purpose in choosing to summon Egan to this particular spot. The atlas showed that a bridge had once crossed the river at Musket Island. Probably the structure had been washed out decades earlier during an especially damaging ice jam. But there were approaches on both sides and an icon indicating a boat launch on the north shore. No doubt some of the old pilings remained. From experience, I knew that bridge supports can be dangerous places to paddle, both as obstacles in your way, but also because currents flow faster where they are squeezed together. The logging road from Dickey to the boat launch above Musket Brook was surprisingly well maintained. Fresh gravel had been spread and graded, and there were periodic bumps where new culverts had been installed to channel spring freshets under the hard-packed surface. Fully loaded logging trucks can weigh up to 80,000 pounds. As a consequence, timber companies were also forced into the road maintenance business. I passed a few buildings, their lights shining hazily up through the trees from the riverside. The timber company had leased waterfront plots to people to build vacation cabins. This arrangement was commonplace in Maine, although less common than it had once been. I drove into the first unattended camp. As I'd expected, the owner had a canoe. He had secured it with a chain to the biggest hemlock on the property. Unfortunately for him, fortunately for me, I kept a pair of bolt cutters in my vehicle. This wasn't the first occasion I'd had to borrow a boat. I wasted no time tying the stolen Old Town to my roof rack. From there, it took me 15 minutes to cover 5 miles. In the backcountry of Maine, that is called making good time. As I descended the hill to the St. John River, I saw the old bridge looming in my high beams. The timber company had bulldozed boulders at its base. The rocks were intended to stop some drunken fool from driving headlong into the channel. As I braked and turned, my headlights caught the reflectors on the back of Egan's Tacoma, parked in a patch of sweet fern. He had towed a boat with him and backed the trailer into the water to launch the craft. When I opened the door of my scout, I could hear the rapids downstream. My muscles had grown even stiffer from the rollover. Like an arthritic old man, I limped through the woods along the river. I crushed wintergreen beneath my boots, loosing a minty, medicinal scent from the leaves. There was no moon, no light from the sky beyond a pale cast, but I could feel the towering pilings of the old bridge looming above me like the coldness of a shadow. I squinted at where the island should be and saw a light flickering, definitely a campfire. There it was, the bait in Charlie's trap. But had Egan taken it? I cut the ropes I had used to tie the canoe to the top of the scout and positioned myself to take the weight of the broad-beamed boat onto my sore shoulders. I walked the overturned canoe up the shoreline, my tendons burning, my boots slipping on the loose gravel. The current was too strong for me to cut straight across. If I attempted the shortest route, I would find myself carried past the island before I could make 3 paddle strokes. I would need to launch from upstream, I realized. Fortunately, the hull was made of polyethylene, which is lighter than aluminum or white cedar. The hill above me was steep, and I reached a drop-off that impeded my portage upriver. I had no choice but to flip over the canoe into the water and secure the painter to the branch of an overhanging birch while I went to fetch the paddle. I strapped on a 500 lumens headlamp, the most powerful light I had with me. I took hold of the beaver tail paddle and used it to steady myself as I sat down in the center of the canoe. When paddling solo, the middle is where you usually want to be. Then I leaned forward and gave a yank to the quick release end of the rope. The knot, a highwayman's hitch, slipped free of the branch, and I was torn adrift in the stream. I turned the canoe with a series of sweep strokes so that my bow was facing downriver. I thought I'd carried the canoe a fair ways up from the bridge, but it was only seconds before the foundations reared up dead ahead. I sideswiped the whitewater eddy in front of the nearest pier and let the current pull me to the inner channel. Musket Island was shaped like a football, narrow at the top and bottom, fat in the middle. I aimed for the pointed end. I needed to paddle hard to keep from being swept back into the deep water. My shoulder ached. I have decent balance for a normal human, but not for a Northwoods waterman like Charlie. I didn't dare stand up in the canoe. Instead, I slid over the gunwale into the river, going in all the way to my waist. The early summer water was warm, but not so warm that I didn't feel a stabbing pain in my groin. Once I had found my footing, I turned off the headlamp. In the dark, I walked the canoe up the shallows, feeling that strange sensation you get in moving water of unseen hands tugging at your ankles, until I heard the bottom scrape gravel. Then I lifted the bow and did my best to muscle the thing onto dry land, all while remaining hunched over. I had seen the campfire at the bottom end of the football and wanted to approach with as much stealth as possible, given that the only cover on the low-slung island was a ridge of alders and willows running down the spine. I kept low, then went lower, and finally began to crawl on hands and knees. Leopard frogs sprang up ahead of me from the wet weeds. Some of the grass blades had serrated edges and cut my hands.
"Come on up, young feller. You've been spotted."
The son of a bitch. I rose to my feet, swiped my palms on my pants legs to remove the muck, and waded through the sedges to the two men I now saw seated across a small wood fire from each other. John Egan, wild-eyed in the firelight, sat upon a skinned log that could only have rolled into the river from the back of someone's truck. His arms were bound behind him, and a kerchief was knotted in his open mouth. Charlie sat opposite him on a small boulder, resting his old service revolver, a Smith & Wesson 357 Magnum, on one bouncing knee. His head was just as disconcertingly bald as I'd remembered, and he was dressed in the same faded coveralls. They appeared vintage, as if he'd scavenged them from Goodwill, but I could have sworn that the American flag sewn on the chest was new.
"What the fuck, Charlie?"
"I'm sorry, Mike."
"What are you doing? Why is he tied up like this?"
"I felt bad about what you said, about me using you as bait. So I decided to switch to Mr. Egan here."
"Bait for who?"
"Roland Michaud, of course. He killed Scott, and he killed that poor girl Angie when he found out she sold off that badge. She didn't know that it linked her boyfriend back to what happened here 15 years ago.
Egan screamed into his cloth gag, shook his head violently, and rocked back and forth on his log. The red-headed man nearly toppled over backward. Charlie's theory baffled me. It was so full of holes.
"Roland was in New Brunswick the night Angie was strangled, Charlie. I was in the room for his interrogation. He has people who can vouch for him, including customs officials.
I've spoken to one of his so-called witnesses. I haven't been as idle as you think.
One of those impartial customs officials Roland mentioned just happens to be his Canadian cousin.
Charlie, it wasn't Roland.
We'll find out soon enough.
If you're convinced that you're right, why are you holding a gun on Egan?
Because I intend to kill him.
The word came out in one breath.
What? If Mr. Egan here doesn't tell me where they disposed of Scott's body, I'm going to brain him with this pistol and toss his body into the St. John. The police will think he overturned in the rapids.
You wouldn't do that.
I know you believe that, son, but the last few days have tested me, and, well, I've learned I'm not the man I thought I was. I failed Scott, but I am going to avenge him tonight, so help me God.
I felt the first stirring of a breeze on my cheek, saw the wood smoke shift direction, even begin to rise. How many days had the stagnant heat sat motionless over us? So what do you expect is going to happen, that Roland is going to come motoring out here?
That's the general plan, yes.
That's ludicrous. In the flickering firelight, Egan's face had turned nearly the same shade of red as his hair. I worried he was going to hyperventilate before Roland even arrived.
You're not a murderer, Charlie. I killed Pierre.
You shot Pierre. He drowned trying to get away.
I tried to kill him, though. And how can you be sure Nick and I didn't just let him drown?
I didn't believe this last statement, not remotely.
Where is Nick?
Not here. I didn't want to include him in this if things go wrong.
But you included me?
More than once, Mike. I told you to stay out of this.
For Christ's sake, Charlie!
I took a step toward him, but a pitiless look came into his eyes that stopped me cold.
This isn't you. At least take Egan's gag off so he can breathe.
If I do, he'll call out and give us away. The man on the log shook his head vigorously to indicate he wouldn't ruin our plans.
How can you be certain Egan knows where they hid Pellerin's body? The warden service searched half the county for it.
And the Mounties searched their side of the border, too. But I think you might have guessed why I suspect Mr. Egan here was a party to a conspiracy. It has to do with a certain identifying mark.
I pointed at the bound man. Can I see for myself?
Just so long as you cut the cloth and not the ropes. I removed my knife from my pocket and pressed the button that opened the automatic blade. With the razor-sharp tip, I cut a hole in the shoulder of Egan's shirt. The dancing light didn't reveal much of the tattoo beyond the greenish-black ink. But I didn't need to see the design. I only needed to run my fingers over the raised skin to feel the old scar.
Pierre Michaud branded everyone who participated in the killing, I said. That way they couldn't lie and claim they weren't there for the murder.
They could still rat him out, though, said Charlie. I have no doubt that Mr. Egan was tempted to do so, but the prosecutor would have had a problem getting a reduced sentence for a self-identified cop killer.
Pierre Michaud was a shrewd man, one of the coldest and most ruthless men I've come up against, but not shrewd enough to escape. He underestimated the wrong person.
For the past few minutes, I had felt like I was having a conversation with a dangerous stranger, a man whose actions I couldn't predict, possibly someone capable of unprovoked violence. But I recognized something of the old Charlie as he spoke those words. He underestimated the wrong person.
He wasn't referring to himself. He was talking about the person who'd told him where to look for Pierre.
It hadn't been a coincidence that he and Nick had spotted the Poacher King crossing Bow Lac that night. They had been tipped off.
I understood now.
This trap hadn't been set for Roland Michaud.
Chapter 42. As I processed this revelation, I listened to the rapids below us in the darkness, the steady rush of falling water. It was an ominous sound that spoke of dangers impossible to see or avoid.
You're not going to kill Egan, I said.
Scott was like a son to me, Charlie said, his voice creaking. More than you, even.
It would have broken my heart if I didn't know better. I knew what I had to do next. I hardened myself to do it.
I'm cutting him loose. Then I'm taking him back to Fort Kent. He's going to give a full confession to Xanadakis. I won't tell anyone what you did to him, Charlie, and Egan won't either, will you?
Once more, the gagged man tried to signal his enthusiastic compliance.
I can't let you arrest him, Mike. He has to pay the price for what he did. He will. Blood is the only currency that matters.
I knelt down on the hard-packed sand beside Egan with the knife in my grip. He was sweating hard. The odor coming off him was the uniquely sour smell that comes from fear. Charlie rose to his feet, bulky in those ridiculously loose coveralls.
Get away from him, son.
I rose to my feet, feeling the breeze again on my sweaty neck. I won't do that. Charlie raised the revolver at me. The barrel was aimed at my kneecap. Those old Smith & Wessons were massive guns. A .357 Magnum round would have amputated my lower leg.
Back away!
No. He cocked the hammer, curled his index finger around the trigger.
Please, Mike, I don't want to do this.
You won't be able to live with yourself if you do.
Don't test me!
I pulled down the gag over Egan's chin. He coughed, gasped out a few ragged breaths, and then spoke a single tortured word.
Forge!
Of course. It was what the investigators had feared at the time, why they'd found no evidence, why we never would. Pierre Michaud, trained blacksmith, had dismembered Pellerin and burned him, piece by piece, in his smithy. Charlie's lip curled with contempt.
You saw Pierre do it?
Some of the capillaries in Egan's eyes had popped, giving him a hobgoblin gaze.
We all did.
Who's we? I asked, unable to contain my contempt.
Me? Roland? Zach?
Most killers would have wanted as few witnesses as possible, but Pierre Michaud had seen the wisdom of incriminating his entire crew. He knew the butchery would haunt the men who followed him. He was confident in his ability to intimidate them into lifelong silence.
And then Pierre gave you those brands so you'd all be implicated, I said.
Egan worked his jaw, sore from the rag he'd had stuffed between his teeth.
He said he'd do himself last, but he didn't. Never planned on doing it. What were we going to do, though? Pierre would have killed any of us who challenged him.
I snapped my head around at Charlie. Are we done? The old man's features remained stony, but he eased down the hammer, slid his finger from the trigger guard, and turned the barrel of the revolver back to the sand.
Yes, said Charlie in a voice softened by shame and grief.
Please tell me that isn't loaded, I said.
It isn't.
Egan spat and sputtered.
What?
You violated all four rules of safe gun handling there, I said. Three of them at least, the old man answered with a sad smile.
The character he'd been playing, cruel, vengeful, crazed, had disappeared in the night.
I'm sorry, Mike. I had to be convincing. I could only hope that you would sense that I was acting and understand why.
Egan had begun to blink furiously, as if he had sand in his eyes. It didn't make it any more pleasant, I said. Where's Roland, really? Charlie glanced at his wristwatch.
If I had to guess, he said, rubbing his hand over his head, already fuzzed white with stubble, he's in the custody of the Canada Border Services Agency for attempting to transport a pound of heroin into the city of Edmundston, New Brunswick.
Once again, I found myself catching my breath.
You didn't plant drugs on him. Yes and no. That smack belonged to Roland, all right. I just happened to steal it from under the outhouse where he had it hidden and hide the bag in his gas tank. That was his usual M.O. Dogs can't smell narcotics through petroleum.
This time, though, the Canadians had an anonymous tip to prod around in the tank.
So you're a vigilante, too, in addition to being a kidnapper.
Charlie glanced at Egan, still bound, but no longer blinking and breathing more regularly now.
Do you plan on accusing me of kidnapping, Mr. Egan?
No.
I crossed my forearms across my chest.
The man's terrified. Wait till he's free and has a lawyer to advise him. You're in big trouble here, Charlie.
It's been a while. Truth is, I kind of missed the experience, don't you?
I didn't want to admit that I missed our unsanctioned escapades. I hope you're done tormenting Egan, at least.
I wish I was, said Charlie.
But we're still waiting on someone to make his appearance.
The breeze was picking up. Stars appeared, first hazily and then sharply, in the gaps between the clouds overhead. I actually shivered from the chill of my wet pants. I saw the boat that must have been Egan's, a square-sterned Grumman Sport with a two-stroke engine mounted to the transom. Personally, I wouldn't have trusted the underpowered craft in the river at night, and certainly nowhere near rapids. It occurred to me that I hadn't seen another boat, canoe, or kayak on my short trip across the island. How had Charlie gotten here? The question could wait.
You picked a vulnerable spot to set a trap.
Our man wouldn't come if he didn't think he had us at a disadvantage.
A night scope and a hunting rifle are all he needs to end this once and for all.
He won't shoot on sight because he doesn't know what we've discovered or whom we've told.
But he has to know this is a setup. The story about the Indian flipping his canoe? Come on.
Your father was a trapper, the old man said. Didn't he ever set two traps, one after the other? Mr. Fox would think he was smart avoiding the first, then catch himself in the second.
Who's the fox in this story? But before he could answer, we heard the sound we'd been anticipating. It was the low roar of an outboard motor heading toward Musket Island from upstream. A handheld spotlight showed on the surface of the water, which was as black as crude oil where the channel deepened. The boatman must have launched back an Allagash.
How are we going to play this? I said to Charlie. I take it you don't have proof that we'll stand up in court.
He'll give us what we need if he doesn't kill us first.
You need to untie me, said Egan.
I put the knife back in my pocket and checked my Beretta. The pistol had gotten wet in the river, but it was the most dependable firearm I had ever owned. Charlie flipped open the chamber of his revolver and reached into his pocket for bullets.
I guess I should load this.
Egan nearly burst into tears again.
It was empty?
You wearing your vest? Charlie said, meaning the lightweight body armor that protected my torso beneath my shirt and rain jacket.
Always, I said, tapping my sternum. Ever since I got shot in that gravel pit. He smiled and winked.
Maybe you stand in front of me then.
It's not much help if he aims at my head. If I remember right, he's a good shot.
Charlie dropped a bullet. As he stooped to pick it up, I saw Big Al's auto sewn in reflective letters on the back of his coveralls. They were two sizes too large on his wiry frame.
You need to untie me, said Egan again.
The boat was coming fast downstream. He knew the river, its channels, and currents. He was unafraid of it. He kept the spotlight on our faces, blinding us the way a poacher does a deer, until he slipped alongside the island. The diminishing light of the campfire revealed him standing tall in the stern of the Grand Laker, with his hand on the throttle. He let the river carry the boat past the island and then gave the outboard some gas and came straight back at us in the lee. He rammed the bow of the square-sterned canoe into the sand as if he'd done that maneuver 100 times before. He probably had. As he was always quick to remind us, Chasse La Montaigne had grown up on this river.
Chapter 43. The game warden we'd mocked as Dudley Do-Right was dressed in his fatigue-colored uniform,
wearing his duty belt and his ballistic vest fortified with ceramic plates in the front and back. He had eschewed a personal flotation device. He kept his hand on the grip of his sidearm, a SIG P226, with a magazine holding 12 357 rounds. He probably had a bullet in the chamber, too.
"Charlie Stevens, you've lost your hair. Misplaced it is more like it.
There must be a mistake. I heard a distress call about an Indian getting himself stranded on this island, but instead of finding Crazy Horse, all I see are three horses' asses." Who was this man? Even his voice sounded different, quick and confident.
"I never knew you were funny, Shas," I said. "One of the many things you didn't know, I expect. Why's your hand on your sidearm, Mike? We're all fellow wardens here. No need to be jumpy."
I kept my hand where it was.
"So you've come to rescue us, then," said Charlie. "Do you need rescuing? My first thought was that this was a prank you decided to play on me. I'm used to being the butt of jokes. I know wardens think I'm some naive Boy Scout."
"It must bother you," I said.
"The opposite," he said. "People are never so dumb as when they think they're putting something over on somebody smarter than they are. Charlie, that shaved head of yours is freaking me out. Were you afraid to come back here except in disguise? More like I wanted to keep a low profile. Too low, I think, given where we are."
He cast a glance at Egan, who had gone as motionless as a fawn, hoping not to be noticed by a predator in the tall grass.
"You've looked better, John. Shas?"
"So seriously," said LaMontagne, "what's this about?" Charlie tossed a small object into the light cast by the burning driftwood. It landed with a clink on the river-polished gravel. A miniature metal shield.
"I suppose you recognize this," said the pilot. "Looks like a toy badge. You get it out of a gumball machine?" "It's real enough. And you have no idea whose badge it is?"
Shas let out a pretty convincing chuckle.
"It's kind of hard to identify from 20 feet away." "Come have a closer look," said Charlie. "I will when you gentlemen take your hands off your sidearms."
"The badge belonged to Scott Pellerin," I said.
"Pellerin was undercover," said Shas,
sounding genuinely mystified.
"He wouldn't have had a badge with him." "Actually, it belonged to Scott's grandfather," said Charlie. "Emmeline Bouchard found it hidden in the room Scott was renting at the Valley View. No doubt Pierre had told her to search the place from time to time. Scott must have gotten careless hiding the thing." "So that's how Pierre found out that Pellerin was a warden."
"You're acting like this is news to you," I said.
"Of course it is. Pierre never told anyone before he died, except Emmeline, of course. I'm surprised she didn't let that slip later, when I would visit her at the motel."
So Shas had had an affair with Angie's mother, too. Emmeline Bouchard's taste in men couldn't have been worse.
"You remember what a cold-blooded bastard Pierre was," LaMontagne continued. "Killing that man was the best thing you've done. I know you're too honorable to admit that, or maybe that's another lie you tell yourself."
"I've told myself plenty, that's true."
"Maybe you don't like to remember what you did."
"Maybe," Charlie said.
"It's true my memory's gotten more selective. But I remember one thing from that manhunt as clear as last night. It concerns you, Shas. I remember how it was you who kept asking to go with me in my plane to look for Pierre. You said you knew this land better than any outsider, even though you were just a deputy warden back then."
"It was the truth. I know every inch of this river and its tributaries. I hurt your pride when I refused. I told you there was only room in the cub for two, and I trusted Nick Francis."
He shrugged his broad shoulders.
"It was your prerogative. What I didn't admit, to myself or to you, was that I already had a sneaking feeling about you."
"Why was that?"
"Because of how insistent you were that we fly over Beau Lac. You said Pierre kept an old canoe chained to a tree there. You said he would try to cross before the clouds cleared and the moon came out. Nick and I thought you were just trying to prove your own importance.
We were surprised when we actually flew up that way, and there was a man in a canoe trying to slip across. I'm not sure we gave you the credit, though.
No, he said, sounding piqued. You didn't. Not that you wanted it, I'm guessing. It wasn't the moment for you to call attention to yourself.
Charlie, are you accusing me of helping Pierre Michaud escape?
The suggestion seemed to amuse him.
The opposite. You wanted to make sure Pierre didn't escape.
And why would I do that? He deserved to die for what he did to Pellerin. I believed it then, and I believe it now.
Why else did you shoot him if you didn't agree?
Nick and I did everything in our power to save that son of a bitch's life, despite his horrible crimes.
Sure you did.
The Boy Scout had turned out to be as cynical as a career criminal.
Suppose what you're saying is even half true. Suppose I had a hunch where and when Pierre was going to try crossing the border.
So what?
The word you're looking for is complicity, I said.
Shut up, Bowditch, he said. No one cares what you think.
You stage-managed Pierre Michaud's death, I said.
Prove it.
We can't, said Charlie. He actually laughed at that.
So what are we all doing here?
The gravel rustled as Charlie shifted his weight.
I consider myself a pretty fair actor. I can play as dumb as Lieutenant Columbo when the situation calls for it. But you, Shas, have a true gift for letting people believe you're a numbskull.
LaMontagne's voice hardened.
Did you come all the way up here to insult me, or are you accusing me of something? I had nothing to do with Scott Pellerin's death.
I think you did, said Charlie. I think you went to work as a deputy warden with an agreement to cover for Pierre Michaud. You promised him protection in exchange for a cut of his profits. You've always boasted how you grew up here and knew everyone in the valley.
I was just a deputy. I had no authority.
But you had information about where the wardens would be laying their ambushes. You made it easy for the Michauds to stay one step ahead. And then you tried to use the situation to secure a full-time job where you would have been even better positioned to protect their illegal activities.
The accusation amused Shas.
Are you accusing me of being Pierre's mole in the service?
Not a good one. He must have been pissed that you failed to recognize Scott Pellerin when you met, I said, taking a shot in the dark.
Shas's reaction, his refusal to rebut the statement, confirmed my guess.
If you guys are accusing me of being a party to a criminal enterprise, let alone a cop killing, he said with a sneer, then go ahead and prove it.
You won't be able to.
How about showing us your shoulder, then? I said.
My shoulder?
I suspect you have a brand on it from the hot iron that Pierre used to implicate the men in his crew.
Fuck you, Bowditch.
It had to be you, Shas. When I showed up at Angie Bouchard's house asking about the badge that linked her mom to Scott Pellerin's death, who did she seek out for advice?
Somewhere out in the channel, a big fish thrashed in the water, chasing bait. It could only have been a muscle lunge.
You're the only warden she knew, I continued. She wanted you to tell her that her mom had no connection to Pellerin's murder. Children hate to believe the worst about their parents.
You know, Bowditch, Shas said, not all of us are as bloodthirsty as you are. How many lives do you have on your conscience now? I have never personally killed another human being in my life, besides which I have an alibi for the time of Angie's death.
Does your son CJ have one too? Said Charlie with some of the old menace.
I bet he doesn't.
You sent CJ to meet Angie at the motel, I said. Maybe you just wanted him to get some information out of her. But he took matters into his own hands, so to speak. You've raised a fine boy, Shas. You're the father of the year.
You can't prove any of this.
There was a catch in Shas's voice as he spoke these words. He had been so careful himself, but he knew what a hothead his son was.
We can prove that CJ was the one who ran me off the road the other day, I said.
I was there, said Charlie. I was too late to intervene, but I passed his truck going the opposite direction and got a decent glance at the driver.
This I happened to know was a lie, since Charlie had been following me, but Shas wouldn't have known. He seemed rattled now.
How are your eyes these days, old man? Sharp enough for a jury to believe you could ID someone speeding in a pickup on a rainy day? I'm sure the paint on Mike's bumper matches your boy's Bigfoot.
It was slang for a pickup modified for off-roading. Some of Shas's cockiness returned.
My son doesn't own a Bigfoot.
Oh, said Charlie. I am sure you ditched it in some bog where it won't be found. But when the state police start asking around about your son's recently disappeared pickup, I'm sure plenty of people will recall certain identifying details.
Now Shas's smile became arrogant.
You've always been a talker, Charlie. But you can't prove any of this. If you could, we'd be having this conversation in an interrogation room and not on a sandbar in the middle of nowhere.
Let's have Detective Xanadakis take a shot at your son, then, I said. How confident are you that CJ won't slip up? I wasn't sure what I expected. I thought his self-confidence might waver for a split second. Instead, Shas LaMontagne somehow had his gun in his hand pointed at Charlie. He had the quickest draw I had ever seen outside a Western. My reflexes took over. I drew my own sidearm and leveled the barrel at his Adam's apple. There is a hollow at the throat left exposed by the ballistic vest. From this distance, I couldn't have missed the mark. Charlie kept his revolver aimed at the ground.
Probably a good time for you two guys to drop your guns, said LaMontagne.
Can't you count, Shas? I said. You're outnumbered here.
Am I?
Suddenly, Charlie collapsed beside me like a marionette whose strings had been cut. A split second later, I heard the rifle shot.